When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 150. Yes, that's right, they said it wouldn't even make 10. And I do just want to take this opportunity to thank each and every one of you for listening and supporting over the last few years, the nice reviews you all leave on the various podcast platforms, and the lovely comments on social media. I can't begin to tell you how much I appreciate it, so a heartfelt thank you to you all. Now, for tonight's show, though, I'm delighted to be heading down to one of my favourite parts of Britain, to the heart of Somerset, to talk to dairy farmer Katrina Dunford. Katrina, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for asking me. It's an honour to be the 150th person you've interviewed, and I hope I deserve being part of your group.
Oh, you've been on my list to interview for a long time, so it's nice to finally get to speak to you now. Now, it's bouncing down with rain outside here. As we're recording this in the middle of August, I've been cleaning out gutters and unblocking drains this morning. Is the weather the same with you, or is it a bit brighter?
It's sunny now. We had 35 mils of rain overnight, so yeah, plenty of rain the last few days, but followed on from a long period of no rain at all.
Yeah, it's been a typical British summer in that regard, isn't it, I suppose? You are not too far from Glastonbury there, a very famous part of the country.
That's right. Glastonbury Festival is actually closer to where I live than Glastonbury, the town itself. And we're only a few miles away from Worthy Farm and the Pyramid Stage. And when the festival's on, we're very lucky enough to get some tickets because we rent a field that they use for access route. So I've been every time for the last 10 years, and yeah, it's great fun. It's the greatest show on earth, as far as I'm concerned. It is amazing, something for everybody, and yeah. It is a dairy farm, and it goes back to being a dairy farm, or several dairy farms, when it's all over. So
I guess it's a big part of the community down there.
Very, very much so. A lot of people are involved one way or another, and there's a lot of enterprise opportunities. Different people help out and do different things, and I think a big part of the economy really, the local economy. So yeah, it's very quiet, as a lot of things have been quiet this year. Very quiet this year about the festival, the build up to the festival, and all the excitement and the action when it's on.
Do you know if it'll be on next year yet or not? Have you got any inside information?
I think all these festivals are really hoping they get the opportunity to go ahead, don't they? And I think it will be a big problem for them if they don't. But no, I'm not that close to the action. I once asked Michael Leavis to tell me what the headline acts were beforehand, but he didn't tell me.
He was tight-lipped. Oh, right, okay. So you live, as I mentioned, in the heart of rural Somerset there, but originally you're a Londoner. You were born in London.
Yeah. Born in London, but moved out to Hertfordshire, so just north of London, when I was four, to that house where my parents still live. And I'm the oldest of four. My dad is a solicitor and went to London every day on the train. And my mum took care of us and the house and the dogs and the cats and the chickens and the ponies. And had a pretty happy and chilled out childhood in sort of just north of London. But no farming involvement at all back then.
Whereabouts in rural Hertfordshire?
Well, a village called Chipperfield, so okay. just outside the M25, sort of about 5-10 minutes drive from the M25. So yeah, not deepest Hertfordshire, just southern Hertfordshire.
Yeah, it's really nice spot. I've got my sister and brother-in-law live in Hertfordshire, and there's some lovely sort of huge National Trust properties and parks and lovely lot of woodland down there as well, isn't there?
That's right. Yeah. No, we lived on the edge of a Chipfield Common, yeah. And yeah, sort of plenty of places to play out in the woods and go for walks and yeah, that sort of stuff.
Is that where living sort of rurally and in the countryside there, is that where your love for animals came from?
I guess so. My parents say that I wanted to ride ponies when we lived in London, and it was part of me negotiating my parents when I was 4 years old that if I moved to a new house that they'd let me have pony lessons, and I did spend my childhood riding and had a succession of ponies and horses and really enjoyed, you know, that caring for animals, I guess.
Yeah.
But no, I did help on a local farm when I was trying to get into vet school, but it wasn't a farm. It, you know, it was a one cow, four pig, 20 sheep sort of farm,
yeah.
And helped out there in the weekends to hopefully help me get into vet school. But it was farms weren't really something that passed my radar.
No, was it easy to get into vet school? Was it quite difficult?
Quite difficult. I didn't get good enough grades the first time around at the school I was at, so I had to retake. And second time around, I got better grades. And at that time, and it's probably different now, but there was only London and Liverpool Vet School would take students that had retaken their A levels.
Okay.
And so that I had a choice of two, and London gave me a place first, so I took the place, and I have never looked back. I've had a, you know, fantastic time at the Royal Veterinary College. Five year degree. First 2 years are in central London, but we quite insular, you know, the vets are sort of vet students stuck together, and
yeah.
I didn't have I have no friends from my uni days that aren't vets, but although their careers have gone in various directions since that time.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
2 years in central London, the uni's in Camden, so, and yeah, hanging out in London, and then 3 years at Potter's Bar, which is just north London into Hertfordshire, at the Royal Veterinary College field station, where we did all the clinical bits. Great opportunity being at uni in London, but I think possibly there are better uni experiences in cities where the university is a more dominant part of the you know, the culture, really.
Yeah it must have been a great experience, though, being at that age living in central London for a few years. I mean, veterinary students are notoriously wild anyway, so you must have had a lot of fun.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, a lot of fun. I can't really remember. It's a long time ago now. qualified 25 years ago now. So this summer. So great memory. Great friend. I mean, the main thing is the friends I still have from that time.
But, Any dodgy fashion choices from back then?
We were so much less conscious of what we were wearing back in those days, I think, compared to nowadays.
Yeah.
Now, I look at videos where of us as me and my sibs as teenagers, and you know, you think, what were we wearing? My children are horrified at what we were wearing, but they we weren't really conscious of it back then.
No.
I wasn't cool and trendy anyway.
Okay. How did you decide to go down the small animal route? Did you ever think about becoming a farm animal vet at that time?
I never thought about becoming a farm animal vet, and I when you qualify as a vet, you are omnicompetent, you know, trained in everything, but you certainly, people have their specific interests. And I really wanted to work with horses, but I started in a mixed practice in Essex, where I had the opportunity to do horse work and small animal work.
Okay.
And really fairly quickly, I kind of worked out that there are a lot more opportunities to do a lot more interesting things from my point of view, in small animal practice, and I really enjoyed surgery. So okay. You can have a long list of operations to do on a particular day, the neutering, lump removals, wound repairs. Whereas as an equine vet in that the practice that I was in, you were sort of driving around the countryside, sort of vaccinating ponies and rasping teeth. And I suppose I maybe wasn't in the best practice to get the best horse opportunities, and I did and certainly some memories of feeling a bit out of my depth taking care of beautiful horses on my own, whereas in the small animal practice I thrived and really enjoyed mainly small animal surgery and the busy caseload and the practice environment where you've got a team working together. Yeah.
I guess some of those horses are worth a fortune as well. Must be a lot of pressure on.
Absolutely. I think I did suffer a bit with my love of horses, really. I just didn't feel quite well enough in control to do a good job.
So what it must have been interesting though, working as a small animal vet in those early days. What were your favourite animals to work with? Dogs?
Yeah, a lot of opportunities with dogs. I guess it's more what I could do to them. So it's what operations they needed. No particular surgery as opposed to medicine was always the big being the hero, fixing the problems. Really, I do remember what once when this antenatal class is telling the group that I castrated 5 different species in a particular day. So I don't think I ever topped that. So I can't even remember what they were. Cat, dog, rabbits, guinea pig, maybe something else all in one day.
What's the strangest animal you ever had to treat? Or the most exotic animal?
Well, when moving on a bit, where the practice I worked at, I came to work in Froome, was the practice for Longleat. And so although I wasn't ever the vet for Longleat, certainly some exotic animals came into the practice, the ones that could be put in a box and brought in for anaesthesia and things like that. And yeah, I've certainly seen some monkeys and different animals like that brought into the practice there.
Well, that's really cool. Interesting. So how did you meet your husband, Mark?
Well, initially met Mark through young vets from the Royal Veterinary College were spread all around the country in different practices, and a friend of mine was working in Somerset over near Bridgewater, and as things, you sort of made friends in the local area, and I came to spend the weekend with her and met Mark through mutual friends back in the late 90s, and hit it off straight away, which is great. And I have a story to tell you about an animal story related to Mark and how our first date all went a bit crazy, or the run up to it more than that. That Mark and I met, and we arranged a date sort of two weeks time, because I was on call a particular weekend, and that weekend I actually got bitten on the wrist on the tendon sheath by a cat, and the next morning, so Monday morning, my arm had swelled and I was really ill, and ended up being taken to hospital and was on intravenous antibiotics.
Oh, no.
I remember back in the days when people didn't have mobile phones, and I by about Wednesday I was conscious that I may not make it out of hospital by the weekend for this date with the first date with Mark. So I confessed to my mum, who was coming to see me every day, that this was on the cards, and she took it upon herself to go to my cottage, find Mark's phone number and phone his home, which is my home now, here now, and I can imagine that. And that, again, back in the days where, so she phoned the home, my mother-in-law, now mother-in-law, Hillary, answered the phone, and then because Mark was out in the yard somewhere, she shouted for Mark, because again, back in the days when farmers used to come in at lunchtime and breakfast to make their phone calls, and if it was important, somebody would shout for you. you. So he came running up to the house and spoke to my mum, and my mum explains that I was in hospital. Anyway, luckily he still, I got out of hospital that weekend, and he came to see me. And came to see me first day at my, I was still under antibiotics at my parents' house, but yeah, I hit it off, and I spent the rest of that year driving down to Somerset pretty much every weekend I wasn't on call. Yeah, hanging out with Mark on the farm, and at the end of that year, yeah, moved down to Somerset and been here ever since.
Yeah. So did you get a feeling for the area straight away? Because obviously Essex to Somerset, quite a big move, really.
Well, yes. No, I don't. I mean, driving, never been down the 303 before in my life, and obviously I've done that many times now. But driving past Stonehenge for the first time was quite impressive. Okay. And it's a lovely part of the world here. Where my farm is, we're kind of on a little bit of a hill, and we have a great view all around us. We, you know, see up to the Mendips, and there's a hill between us and Glastonbury, but we see in that Glastonbury direction. Mm. And yeah, it's really a special, fun part of the world.
Yeah. And Mark's family have been there for quite a long time, haven't they, in that area?
Yeah, so Mark's grandfather moved to this farm, bought this farm in the 1930s, and had raised his family, which was my mother-in-law, here in this house. And then when Mark's mum, Hilary, she married and had Mark and his brother, Pete, they moved to Australia for 10 years. So Mark's sort of 5 to 10-year-old age was in Australia, and so he didn't really, although he was born here, he didn't grow up on the farm. Mm. And they came back from Australia when he was about 15, because Mark's grandfather didn't want to continue running the farm alone. Mm. And he said no one wanted to help sort of take over, he would sell it. So mm-hmm. Hilary, her husband Mark, Pete, and their younger sister Caroline all came back and moved into the farmhouse and helped him. And Mark never went back to Australia, which I think was always a regret for him. But it was a very happy time of his life. And I think coming back to wet Somerset from sunny Australia, he didn't particularly enjoy the school he went to, and he really seemed to, he got stuck in on the farm helping his grandfather, really enjoyed helping his grandfather. And I think it was quite a small beef farm at that stage, sort of smaller area than we have now. And within a couple of years, Mark was lined up to, he went to Cannington in Bridgewater to do a diploma in agriculture. Mm-hmm. That's how he met the friends that I met in Taunton. Okay. Taunton.
So that's, it all comes together. I see.
so that a great group of our friends are all from that Taunton area. So he never worked anywhere apart from his sandwich year. He never worked anywhere else but here on the farm. Well, look, mm-hmm. his father was a builder, so although again very helping on the farm, he had a separate business. And so Mark from his early 20s was really working here alongside his grandfather. I think was keen to establish a dairy farm. Mm. I think because they weren't making much money as a beef farm, and the opportunity for a bigger income, and I think also to be able to, I think Mark was quite lonely working with just his grandfather, so the opportunity of having a bigger enterprise actually meant that he'd be able to employ people and have young people to work with. And so that happened. And you know, looking back, it's one of those things that, with many things, you wish you asked more or understood more. Yeah. But you never do, and you probably don't. You always think you've got time to go mm-hmm. back over these questions. But it was in the early 90s that Mark established a dairy farm here, put in a 1616 second-hand parlour. And so started with 25 cows, and it was in the time of when you had to buy quota, you had to have quota.
Yeah.
And quota was selling for 60 pence a litre. Or
yes, an easy time to start in dairy farming, was it? It must have been very, very determined to get it going.
Absolutely. I think he had some eye-watering loans for pieces of paper, in effect. And when quota actually, you know, was abolished, they were worthless, really. But they were all bought and paid for, and were the basis of his expansion of the farm. And he very ambitious, very hardworking, very capable. But there were times, again, this may make more sense to some people than I actually really understand, but there was times in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, when he was producing more milk than he actually had quota for, and it was a real gamble. You know, you had this super levy day, or you'd wait until find out if the country was over or under quota, and you'd actually whether you were going to get paid for that milk. Yeah. And I think, you know, he was lucky a few times there.
It's hard to imagine. I mean, we were dairy farming here until 2008, and so I remember my mum and dad having a lot of stress over quota, sort of through the 80s and 90s, and as you say, sort of having to buy almost a piece of paper, a license to produce it. And now it seems really alien, doesn't it, somehow?
Absolutely.
So, and I guess Somerset, that area, is very suited to dairy production as well, isn't it? High rainfall, very good grass growth.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of dairy farms around here, so a lot of dairy processes as well. My milk goes to Arla on the Tesco contract, but I'm a mile, less than 2 miles away from both Barbers and Wyke. So big dairy area around here.
Late 90s, early 2000s, that's when you started a family, three children. Did you start to get involved in the farm and business around that time?
Well, not really. Max was born in 2001, Lara 2003, and we did move into the farmhouse here between that time. So Mark's parents moved to a cottage in a local town. So I did help, and, you know, being the wife of a farmer as opposed to a farmer's wife, you know, if you're called on to help, you help, you know, go and pick things. I mean, but I did have toddlers in tow, and Max certainly was crazy mad on the farm right from the beginning. And so he would often hang out with Mark, and I did do the bookwork. And I did the data. I mean, Mark wasn't particularly computer savvy, so I did do the data entry on data entry for the cows and things like that. So I did a bit, but I didn't know where all our fields were. I certainly didn't know where any water plumbing pipes were or things like that.
Go on, sorry.
Go on. Well, Tallulah makes up the three. She was born a bit later, 2006. So the noughties were, you know, I had three little children, and more of a yummy mummy and a part time vet than the farmer in any way at all.
Yeah, I guess those early noughties, that sort of 5 year period was probably all a bit of a blur for you, if it's anything like our experience with young children.
Exactly. I've just my three sisters' three children just been here for the last 24 hours, and they're that sort of age now, and it is pretty full on.
Yes, it is. It is.
About how exhausting it is compared to teenagers, where as long as there's Wi-Fi and they've got a phone, they're fairly happy.
Yeah. So in 2004, you and Mark got a real big opportunity to take on a bigger farm.
But yes, that Mark, when you say you and me, it was really Mark, not me. But he, a farm not a few miles away from here, 2 or 3 miles away, the dairy unit was sold. And so Mark took on an FBT there, a bigger farm, larger grazing area, better parlour than we had here. And so he moved the 200 cows that we had at that time to that farm, and bought another 100 cows. And so was at that time milking 300 cows on this FBT unit just down the road. And the farm here, it was all put down to maize for a couple of years. Which I know that now, because we're about to start reseeding the grazing, and we can remember that's the last time we actually did any reseeding, was a good 15, 16 years ago. And so Mark's ambition was to be a bigger farm, a bigger and bigger the whole time, and more. And that farm, that tenancy did come with quota, and so that quota stopped being something to worry about back then, because he inherited or babysat all that quota as well as part of the tenancy. And then a few years later, so probably 2007, established cows back at home again. So by that sort of time, I think we had about 200 cows at home and 300 cows at Bagborough, which is just down the road. And pretty full on, pretty busy. Mark was led from the front, very hard working, had a great character, and had some great characters working for him. I guess a bit of a whirlwind, working very hard. But again, I can't really say I really was probably paying much attention to what was actually happening.
It's quite incredible to go from milking 25 cows in the early 90s to 500 in the mid 2000s. That really is some success story, isn't it?
I agree, and I think it's something I'm more and more aware of now. Yeah. At the time it was just happening. It was just what Mark did, and I knew no different. So just let him get on with it, really.
Just help. Because there were BSE in the 90s. There were a challenging time as well, wasn't it? Really,
absolutely. You know? And I think foot and mouth in 2001. Luckily, yeah. didn't affect us here at all. But the very very early day or days when there was outbreaks, sort of one side of us and the other side of us, and if you drew a line on with a ruler, we were right in the middle. But it transpired that it was all transport links, really. So the animals had luckily our part of Somerset were unaffected. But it was very worrying times.
And when you were milking that number of cows as well, also employing 5 to 6 people, and obviously, as you said, Mark wanted to employ people and obviously was a people person as well.
Yeah, there's always challenges, aren't there, employing people, and the more people you employ, the more characters you have. And quite kept them busy, that's for sure.
I can imagine. Well, tell us what happened in September 2010.
So it's coming up to the 10-year anniversary now, so the end of September. Mark was being to see the contractor that was drilling wheat in one of the offline fields, and was on his way sort of back home when he saw a stray calf, a steer belonging to a smallholder out on a busy road. So he stopped his truck to sort the situation out. He was a fixer. He wouldn't be some sort of person to leave anything like that unsorted. And the vehicles behind, it was twilight, early evening. The vehicles behind him all stopped and saw what he was doing, but unfortunately an oncoming vehicle was confused, I think, by the headlights, didn't realize what was going on, and did hit him head on. He sustained a massive head injury, but he didn't die there and then. I mean, the next 10 days were an incredible fight for life, really, but not life as we know it, really. And I was called, the chap that was with him called me. I just put the children to bed, and I left them in the house on their own, and went to the scene of the accident. My brother-in-law also came, and we followed the ambulance to first Yeovil and then French A Hospital, which is a big hospital in with a head injury unit in Bristol. And the prognosis was never anything but gloomy, and got worse as the 10 days went on. But the hospital are amazing, and I think there was always in their mind hope of something, miracles, some sort of life. But I think some sort of life isn't a great sort of life. And I think if I ended looking back on it, I think Mark, if he had survived, would have survived with massive problems. And he did eventually, or 10 days later, life support was turned off, and he four of his organs went for transplant, which I guess is something yeah. good to come out of it. And it, extraordinary time. And I came home. I didn't go home in all that time. My mum came from Hertfordshire and started looking after the children that night. And it's something that I do have flashbacks to. I do think about, but it's quite a time, amazing sort of, I don't know, time. You know, it could so easily not. I mean, once the accident happened, the outcome was inevitable. But it could so easily have not happened if Mark had been there 5 or 10 minutes yeah. earlier or later, or he'd turned left rather than right out of the field. And it is part of the strange thing. The life that I'm leading now still doesn't quite feel like my life. I'm taken on his life and trying to do the best I can by it. And then the other thing, I think if he had died there, the scene, you know, I was back home the next morning with my children, I don't know whether I'd have had the same strength to continue on with the farm. But we did have this extraordinary 10 days where the whole community yeah. and the people that work for Mark kept everything going. And my brother-in-law, who isn't involved in the farm but has been incredible support then and ever since, was sort of liaising with the farm staff, running his own business in the day, coming down to Frenchie, showing me bits of paperwork, and we were discussing what to do, and we're going back the next day and sorting things out. And it was really, we were at that time, we were doing everything in case Mark got better, really.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that is one of the things with farming and rural communities in general. I mean, we all sometimes have disagreements with our neighbours and family and grievances and grudges, but I guess with a tragedy like this happens, everybody does generally come together and help, don't they?
Everybody was incredibly helpful, and obviously shocked at what had happened. And yes, I guess looking back, I don't really remember. It was such a whirlwind of a time. And and obviously, I mean, farming it does carry, you know, the actual milking the cows happened twice a day, the maize was harvested, you know, people just got on and made decisions. It's not like you can just shut up shop and wait till you feel better and ready to do something about it. And yeah, lots of people helped me then and have continued to help me ever since.
I'm sure. Did it help having the business and having to, I mean, you got the kids as well and the business to take care of? Did it help you having that to focus on straight away?
Absolutely. I think being busy and yeah. always something to do. Coping, because not coping is an option. But my children's dad had disappeared, and you know, you didn't want their mum to kind of collapse in a heap as well. It was certainly Max, who at the time was 9, when the day that Mark died and we came back from hospital, he listed several things that he needed to be done on the farm, which jobs that needed to be done. So I guess I've been trying to do all those jobs ever since, really. So you know, what there was a real sense of not making any decisions quickly. Mark had, you know, had built such an amazing business that couldn't really just, you know, wrap it all up and say I'm off, really. And and I guess I didn't really know what I was letting myself in for, but we sort of made a decision not to make any big decisions within the first year. So, and that really helped, because a fair amount of the land is tenanted, and tenancies have a break clause in the event of death of a tenant. And so again, you needed to be strong and united front and look like you knew what you were doing. Otherwise, the landlords were in their rights to end the tenancies, and that would have made life even more complicated. So really, with the support of my brother-in-law, we battled on, or kept going, and it was really almost one of the big things that happened in the first year, which is really what's kind of led me to where I am now, was the opportunity came up to buy 30 acres of land immediately adjoining my house. So the farm at that stage was a bit lopsided, so the grazing was all one side of the farm and not really enough to justify a new dairy unit. Mm. Whereas this land that Mark had been sort of hoping for, wishing for, you know, the once in the generation opportunity, came up within a year of him dying. I had to go for it, really. Mm. You know, I think probably in the first two or three years, I still really was fulfilling Mark's plans. It was kind of that's what he wanted to do, so I'd get on and do it, really. And I guess is it easier to do it than not do it? It's easier to be busy than not busy. And it's easier to sort of, don't tell me I can't. You know, if anyone told me I couldn't, if anyone told me I couldn't do anything, I was going to do it, really. Yeah. And so that really was the building. But I mean, there also was an opportunity to buy another 7 or 8 acres, which are still adjoining the grazing block, but further away. So that then really meant that we had enough grazing to justify building a new dairy parlour, which is again something Mark had always wanted to do if he had the opportunity to have enough grass at home.
Yeah.
And so, yes, got on starting designing and building a new dairy parlour. So we have enough cubicles and shed space for 240 cows, but the parlour wasn't really up to it at that stage, and was held together with love and hope.
Yes, luckily.
So it took a while, but then the new dairy parlour, which is a 24-48 swingover unit and a good handling facilities, we built them, and they were sort of ready at the end of 2014, which was great. And at that time, sort of the milking curds were split sort of two thirds, one third up until that time. We then were able to split the milking herds to 250 cows on each farm, spring calving cows at home and the autumn calving cows at the farm down the road.
Was a big part of your motivation to carry on during those years, the children, and giving them the chance to farm if they wanted to? I guess that must have been in the back of your mind.
So I think it was especially, I mean, Max was so keen and so involved from very early age, and he went to boarding school, which were at that time when he was about 12, really, because he had a great time at boarding school, but he was really I could see trouble of him wanting to be on the farm and not concentrate on his education.
That happened to me.
I'm not sure. It sounds like it was a punishment sending him to boarding school. And he went to a fantastic boarding school in North Wales called St David's, which he had great opportunities, but really for his dyslexia, but also because it was a great outdoor ed opportunities. But he, whenever he was home at the holidays, he completely got stuck in on the farm, driving cars and trucks from the age of 12, milking the cows on his own at 14, and I didn't feel the farm was mine not to try and continue and do the best. I'd inherited it from Mark and his family, because I was his wife, his widow, and that's sort of the wills you have when your children are small, and you, because you don't you're not planning to die. And I didn't feel I couldn't stop, but I'm very glad I didn't stop, really. Yeah. And I think my daughters certainly aren't as interested in the farm. The middle one isn't at all interested, and the youngest enjoys being outdoors, but certainly doesn't have the interest in the farm that Max does. But yeah, so certainly this was the life they'd known, the farm, the house they'd grown up in, and to wrap it all up, be the one to call it a day, didn't feel like the right thing to do, definitely. Mm-hmm.
The last 10 years though, it must have been a heck of a learning curve for you. I mean you mentioned earlier, just sort of, I don't know, I guess it's just little things like not knowing where water outlets are and just little things like that must have been very difficult at times.
Absolutely. I mean, I really didn't know anything about, you know the cows get milk, but apart from that, you didn't know where all the fields were and things like, I mean, yeah, water systems, plumbing systems, where pipes are, you know, it's an ongoing mystery, really.
Yes.
and even, you know, if I'm not sure anybody, if you sit down with your wife and told her, like, you know, I really need to tell you where all the water pipes are, would she listen?
Well, my wife doesn't listen to me anyway. Why would she?
And you've got more interesting things to talk about, aren't you, really? And it's one of those things that managing people. I mean, obviously, my focus has in the last is the animals, the cows, and I was definitely, so my foot trimmer very soon after Mark died said, if you take care of the cows, they'll take care of you. Mm. And I, you know, that is something I have really tried as like number one mantra since that time, and really focusing on a healthy, resilient herd of cows, which has made things as good as they are now. The other parts of my knowledge base are worse, like really trying to look after machines is an ongoing challenge. Well, I'm much better on preventative healthcare on animals than machines, but we are getting better on that, really. Yeah. Work in progress. And you know, farming is a crazy business, isn't it? There's just so many out of your control, and you know, you're so dependent on the weather and politics and that sort of stuff. So
yeah. What about big decisions? I mean, I guess for the first few years it was kind of learning how it all worked, but have you had to make any sort of big changes with management over that time?
I mean, the biggest the first big decision I made was to cross. So the cows we had at the time that Mark died were Holsteins, mm-hmm. and I made the decision to crossbreed them. So the next year we served everything to Jersey, and so started producing the Jersey crosses that we have here now. And then the other big thing was to try and.
Why did you make that decision?
Well, it was something that the Mark's dairy consultant had been trying to encourage him to do for over the preceding years, and felt it was the way forward. And I don't really know why Mark hadn't done it, but maybe it wasn't something he was that keen on. But I guess I felt I didn't have anything to lose, really, and so. And Mark had started sort of tentatively tightening up the blocks but hadn't really done much of that. Was I guess didn't like the precision of it, and I again rather foolhardily decided to cut the serving blocks down to sort of 13 weeks in the spring and 13 weeks in the autumn, without really knowing the implications that would have on the future cow numbers, because the submission rates weren't good enough, the cow fertility wasn't good enough, the calf rearing potentially wasn't good enough. Yeah. And so you end up from the sort of the 500 cows over the few years, say 2 or 3 years later, our cow numbers were really quite a long way down from that, from me making the decision without really any knowledge knowledge behind that. Mm. And but then things, once the crossbreds were in the herd and started getting a bit better at management, Mark had been in very much in charge of calf rearing, and when he wasn't and it was just left to whoever wanted to feed the calves, they didn't do so well. And eventually I did take over taking charge of that, and things got better there. And so our cow numbers really started building again, and until the time sort of 2017, 2018, when our tenancy down the road came to an end, and the landlord didn't want to renew it. He had other opportunities. He wanted to take the farm in a different direction.
Yeah, how much warning did you have?
We had a year's notice, okay. and it was an FBT, so it was to come to an end unless he wanted to continue it. So I guess it was always on the cards. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was always inevitable. But I kind of had just got things running quite smoothly with five employees, the two matching blocks of spring and autumn. You have enough labor or love animals then to have full-time labor all year round, and it was working quite well. So I guess I kind of wished it didn't have to change, because we kind of got things in balance and settled. And but anyway, a change happens and you have to deal with it. And I did try quite hard to find somewhere else to move the cows to, but that was beyond me and beyond the time scales. I think, actually having a farm available and the cows and the money, all at the same time, and the people you're almost, you're better having two out of three, and the cows are the easiest one to source. If you have the land and the people, then buy the cows.
It's almost looking up for a needle in a haystack, isn't it? For that many cows and a good setup and everything, and local and all those issues, isn't it?
So it came to the conclusion that they had to be sold, and that was to happen. And that again was very unsettling for the people that worked for me, and some left. Trying to keep the labour force stable during that run up to the end was difficult.
Yeah.
And then so this is all due to end at the end of March 2018, and we had we're in and out of TB in this area all the time, or were back in those days, and we had been clear from TB and had a TB test in the end of January and had reactors, so that meant that I couldn't move the cows from the tenancy, and the person that I had tentatively arranged to buy them was not able to take, DEFRA wouldn't let them have them, even though they're fairly close by, and they would have been happy to take them even under TB restrictions. DEFRA wouldn't allow that, because they already had cattle on the farm. They DEFRA wouldn't block that move, really. So I then then was scrabbling and struggling, and obviously the landlord didn't really have a choice, but he had to extend our tenant because we couldn't move the cattle, and he had to extend the tenancy by 6 months. But he was mainly keen for that. He needed the buildings back, the dairy parlour area, to expand his cheese making business. And I needed to find, there's no guarantee I was going to find anyone else to buy the cows under TB.
Jeez, what a stressful time that must have been.
It was. But luckily, a good outcome there happened, that there was someone relatively near, actually less than 10 miles away, and they were starting a new dairy farm. And the 10 miles is important because DEFRA would allow them to move even if they were still under TB restrictions. And so they were due to start a new dairy in sort of July, August, autumn calving herd. So they agreed to buy the herd of cows even if they're under TB restrictions. And the chap that they was going to be their sort of share milker was newly back from New Zealand. And so he came to milk the cows for me during that time. So that was a lucky thing. So he milked the cows here until the day they moved, and then he went with them and is still involved with them there. But we didn't have enough. That was the the cold, wet. Well, there's been many cold, wet winters, haven't there? we didn't. that winter ended with the beast from the east, which again nearly destroyed me. That was it. And we had one of my employees didn't have, this is a real tale of woe. He had had a motorcycle accident, so was off work for 6 weeks during that Beast from the East period. So we were man down already. And then we went into the summer drought, didn't we, 2018. Yes. So I was very lucky then that the cows actually went, because I didn't have enough. Our first cut forage stocks from the tenanted farm actually fed them before they left. So I wouldn't have had enough forage to feed them all through the winter. So yeah, 2018 was quite challenging, quite upsetting. And two long-term employees had to go with redundancies because they didn't want to be part of the new simpler spring calving setup. Mm-hmm. So again that that was that. Yeah, it was a difficult time. And so and sort of autumn 2018, I sort of an inexperienced assistant herdsman and a new from Cornwall sort of more experienced herdsman and me. And 250 cows just at home. So yeah, it took a bit of getting used to. And the herd of cows were in a good, like, the herd of cows were in a good healthy state. They were, but it was just me battered and bruised and a bit.
TB. TB. I can't sort of speak to a dairy farmer, unfortunately, without asking about TB. And you mentioned the breakdowns you had then. I live in a predominantly dairy farming area here, and TB is all around us. Where are we with bovine TB at the moment here in the UK? I mean, you're a farmer and a vet. Do you think it will ever get better? It feels like it won't at the moment.
Well, I can only say I hope so. Yeah. I mean, mid 2018 we went free. The end of that story, actually, we went free from TB in mid July, and the cows went to their new home TB free. Mm-hmm. And I did, and that autumn was the first year of the cull in this area, and I did. Yeah, we had been TB free from then on, but unfortunately there's a bad part of the story this summer again. So but 2 years into the cull and 2 years of being TB free, we did actually have reactors again this summer, and so back under TB restrictions. And I guess this is a scientist, and I suppose in a farm, I feel more of a farmer than a vet now, to be yes. honest. And I don't have my veterinary knowledge isn't as sharp as it should be. But I think you've got to trust the scientists, or I hope they know what they're doing. And I hope things are getting better. I know the vet that did our TB test just the other week, she said that they have less farms under restrictions and less like reactor animals than they did. So, but anecdotally, you know, is one thing. And then I guess somebody knows all the numbers. And, you know, from an individual farmer point of view, you're either in it or you're not in it, aren't you? And yeah. I guess from a dairy farm point of view, because our main income is milk, and that continues anyway, we're that's okay. It is, from my point of view, trying to find a home for the beef calves, which is just way more complicated than it would be in a normal year. I hope it's getting better, but I can't say it is here yet.
No. Okay, well, moving on to a more cheerful subject. You are on the shortlist for the Farmers Weekly Dairy Farmer of the Year Awards later. Well, it was going to be later this year. Now it's been put back to early next year because of COVID. I mean, that must be, after the sort of decade you've had, that must really mean something to you.
Yes, it does. It's a great honour, and I have to confess, I did submit the application for myself in secret this spring, when you know, I am feeling the 10-year anniversary coming up. I was 39 when Mark died. I'm 49 now. My 40s have been fully engrossed in doing the best by him, his farm, and his children. And I am proud of what I've done. I'm proud to be a farmer. Back in the day, I couldn't it was almost I couldn't bring myself to say I am a farmer. I didn't feel like a farmer. Yeah. And now the dairy herd is in a good shape. I'm proud of what proud of what we've done. The healthy herd. I submitted the form in secret. The only person that knew was my dairy consultant. And if I hadn't been chosen as one of the nominees, nobody would have known. So very exciting. And the judges have been here. They came at the end of June. And as far as I understand it, the decision is made, but we're going to be finalists for a very long time because the awards ceremony has been put back to March next year.
Yes, so. Something to look forward to for you and the family, though. I guess it'll be, whatever happens with the result, you're on a short list of three. I think you're still going to have a brilliant time, aren't you?
Absolutely. It's been really exciting. Everybody's been really kind and, lots of people, mention it. And, it's good to be acknowledged and to try and raise awareness for how amazing dairy farming is, really, and farming.
Okay. What about one thing I wanted to ask you about was women in agriculture. Sometimes people sort of seem to think there's been some good conferences lately in Wales. There's been the She Who Dares Farms conference for women in agriculture, which I know several people who attended, and I know the people who organized it, and everybody who went got a huge amount out of it. Other people say, well, why does it even matter? Because, a farmer's a farmer. Why do you need women in ag conferences? Why do you need women in ag support groups and things like that? What's your opinion on that?
Farming or women have been, I think, the unsung heroes and the backbone of farming probably since the beginning of time.
Yes. They
may not have been called farmers. They were farmers' mothers, farmers' wives, farmers' daughters. Mm-hmm. But they've certainly put a shift in either physically on the farm, milking cows, driving tractors, often on, behind the scenes, maybe doing things that the farmer, the male farmer, didn't necessarily want to do himself. And
what? No way.
I know. It's my mother-in-law, Hillary, was her dad always used to make them go and do, if anybody was sat around doing nothing, they were given a job on the farm, going rolling as a child. Yeah. Farming women, I think, often probably are the driving force behind businesses, and they may have the business brains. They may be the ones that they may not actually be milking the cows, but they are actually have always been doing their bit. But I guess it's the era we're in now, where with representation and people being confident and the opportunities of things like social media, women are possibly maybe starting to shout about it now, or maybe it's more acceptable. Various people over the years have said to me, my dad died, and these are old men, older people who, my dad died, and my mum couldn't keep the farm on, and so so she sold it or had to give it up. And back in the day, it maybe wasn't, people didn't support or weren't able or didn't feel able to support a woman to do this in the way that we are now. And I guess one of my differences to some other women in farming is that they may have grown up on farming and wanted to do it or been thinking about doing it as children and teenagers, mm-hmm. whereas in my case it hadn't actually crossed my mind as something to do. I was quite happy doing what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I think it probably need to have the special Women in Dairy conference. And I listened to the She Who Dares Farms Day as well. It was great. Mm. Men need to be supporting the women to do as much as they can. And I haven't ever you know, my own personal experience, I've been incredibly supported by huge numbers of Mark's friends. I've gone to his buying group, the buying group ever since. I'm virtually always the only female there, and they've been incredibly nurturing and supportive. And there are people there that, you know, I still will just copy whatever they buy. I'm buying, and you know. <it's, laughs> And I will do for the rest of time, you know, yeah. A bit of a spread betting, or, you know, hedging your bets option. If I copy one person on one thing and another person on another thing, I'm probably doing okay.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess it's, you know, I've spoken to many women over the years who grew up on farms but didn't get the chance to farm because the farm was always for their brother. And even now, but would have loved the opportunity to do so. And even now with me, with my four daughters, I very often get asked, my wife and I get asked, you'll keep going for the boy for the farm, will you? We've been, a lot of people have said that to us, both men and women, interestingly. So it shows that it's still there, but I do think times are changing, and for the better as well.
Okay. And another thing, I mean, from a farming point of view, there's almost an expectation that somebody will take on the farm.
Yes.
And you don't, you know, and because it is a family business, and I think maybe some children feel the pressure to do it when they don't necessarily want to, whereas you don't. I suppose it's a difference between family businesses, isn't it? Because maybe in other aspects of society, I don't, you know, if you family butchers, maybe do you expect your daughter or son to take on that business, or the family opticians?
It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, it's quite an interesting thing, that with farming families, isn't it? How we, yeah, I suppose we all, it's perhaps a bit because of the thing you mentioned with your children and with Mark, and we all feel that we're sort of custodians of these farm and the land for a short time, don't we? I suppose. I guess that's a big part of it.
That's right, and I suppose I do feel like a custodian. It's mine for a while, and I want to leave it in a better place for the next generation. But I guess if we weren't, you know, financially, it's got to stack up financially, hasn't it? Or you shouldn't keep doing. You've got to do something different.
Very much so. You talked about the importance of support networks earlier, and the people around you and the community. And I know you've mentioned the discussion group you're part of there, and you are involved in quite a few other things. Is that a big part of your life, having those groups of people?
Definitely. They're groups of people that they become your rocks, or your support network, and you because of your shared experience, you can trust them, and you ask them, and they've got your back, really. And another support group I am part of is the Focus Farmers, which is Holly Beckett. He did a Nuffield project, which developed into this, you start with, I think I've been doing this since 2017, start with a series of short videos about 10 minutes long, which explains the background to Focused Farmers, which is mindfulness meditation and purposeful goals, I think. And so it really is about trying to bring yourself into the moment, dealing with the things that need to be dealt with, not worrying about the things you can't worry about or you can't do anything about, especially the weather, really, and things that worry.
Just looking out the window now. Yes.
Basically, don't worry about the weather. Try not to worry about it ever. You'll eventually get the right weather you want. And if it's the wrong weather, somebody else wants it anyway. And Focus Farmers is again one of my networks. I'm part of a WhatsApp group where we send each other messages and support. Apart from Holly, I don't think I've met anybody on that group. But I think I started for me in end of 2017, and I think it's definitely helped me get to where I am now over the last few years, and kept my head in a better place than it would have been otherwise, really, because it certainly helps keep things in perspective, really. Yes. And my I guess my goal, you know, if I write down my future goals at the beginning of this year, I did write down that I wanted to be a Farmers Weekly finalist, and so having written it down, you've got to go and fill in the application form, and you know, and you keep going, really.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'll give a shout out to Holly as well, because I've also been one of her WhatsApp groups, like sort of a trial thing lately, and it has been, because I'm someone who is easily distracted, as you might guess. Lots of ideas, but I find it quite hard. I'm a bit like a child with a balloon, you know. I'm easily distracted, so it's been really good for me to be able to sit and focus and concentrate on mindfulness and what's around me, and I also try to do that. I know you're a runner. I run as well, and it's something I try and combine with running. I try, and when I'm running, I try to focus on the sounds and the feeling of the air and the hearing the leaves blowing in the trees and that kind of thing. Is that something that you do as well when you're running?
Yes, it is. Running and meditation aren't the same.
No.
But you can sort of meditate whilst you're running. You can't substitute one for the other, but I think it's good to do both, and definitely being out in the weather is good. I tend to listen to podcasts when I'm running now, because it's one of those opportunities when my ears haven't got anything else to do.
No, that's so good to hear. And I'm supposed to be going for a run tonight, and like looking out the window now, it doesn't look very. I'm not very keen about it, but anyway, I will go. Right, Katrina, I've probably kept you long enough, so I will start to wrap this up with the hard hitting questions, if you're ready. What is your all-time favourite song?
Well, I'm probably going to get ridiculed for this, but I think if I could only have one song with me for the rest of my life, it would be The Bare Necessities from The Jungle Book.
That's brilliant. Love that. We've got the Disney album in the car, and my kids pester for it a lot, so that's a really good
song. I think that was my childhood. I think that was probably the only tape we had in the car. Yeah,
brilliant. Mm-hmm. Great choice. As we mentioned, you are a runner. I know that you've already done the London Marathon a few years ago, but which other marathon around the world would you most like to do?
Well, for this, I was just discussing this with my sister before she left, and she said, don't say the one that you're already entered in, which is, I've got a place at Newport next April.
Okay.
And so, so I guess that's the one I'm most looking forward to. But I've got a couple of other suggestions. One at Disney World. Apparently there's a marathon there.
I didn't know that. Wow, okay.
And then one, the Marathon de Sable. How about that? I don't ever want to do that. But
yes, that is hardcore. I interviewed Chris Moon on the podcast who's done that, and it sounded absolutely brutal. I don't think I'll be entering that. But okay, if you could be world class in any sport, what would you choose?
3-day eventing. It has to be back to my first love of horses. So I'd love to be able to ride horses better than I do.
That's good. A really difficult sport too. All those disciplines. Yeah. Incredible. Okay, which band from any era, and they can be living or dead for the purpose of this, would you most like to headline the next Glastonbury Festival? And you can, as a bonus, you can meet them backstage afterwards too.
As someone who thought about this a bit, as someone who doesn't get to choose the music in my own house at all, on my own car, living with a bunch of teenagers, and I've incredibly difficult choice. So, you know, the Eversys and how they put it together, I'm always, you know, it's brilliant. But I did come up with a full lineup with with help from my children. David Bowie in the Legend slots. Oasis, Beyonce and Billie Eilish. There you go. That's
brilliant.
That's what we'd like to see them next year. But
that sounds like obviously. A good day. Fingers crossed. Okay then. And lastly, your favourite agricultural related social media account to follow?
Well, the person that intrigues me, is different, lots of people suggest the same people to you quite a lot, and is Sam Pearson, who's in North Wales, and he intrigues me because I think he's quietly a pretty sharp operator.
He really is.
Yes. And I'd love to know more about his backstory. But yeah. Lots of people are brilliant. You're brilliant, and I think Twitter has been another incredible support network for me. They've been a great help. You can ask questions, and usually somebody gives you a good answer.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Yeah, great sort of virtual friends behind the scenes. Yeah,
Sam is a sharp cookie. I'm supposed to be interviewing at some point, but I've got to go up. I've got to go up to his fish and chip shop and do it there. And I ordered some of his steaks and they arrived earlier. So,
I'd love to hear what he's got to say. I'm intrigued. Get him on.
Good guy. I will try and pin him down. Katrina, it's been fantastic to speak to you. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I know it can't be difficult, but really inspiring to hear about what you've achieved over the last 10 years. And hopefully, I will see you at the Farmers Weekly Awards next March, and I can celebrate with you. I will buy you a very expensive gin and tonic if you win, or if you don't win.
Thank you. That you're on. No, it's been an honour. Thank you. I've loved listening to your podcast since the beginning, and yeah, it's right up there with life goals to be on Rock and Roll Farm.
That's very kind. Well, thank you for being 150th guest. And yes, next time I'm down in Somerset, a very good friend of mine lives just down the road from you, as you know. I will try and we'll maybe call in.
That would be great. Look forward to meeting you properly.
You too. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.